Welcome to the Get Cyber Resilient podcast. I'm Gar O'Hara. Today, we are speaking with Aaron Robinson, the head of pre-sales and security specialist for Citrix. Aaron has been in the IT industry for nearly 20 years, focused on how technology enables business outcomes. He's dedicated to transforming how people work by reimagining the employee experience and increasing productivity and engagement without sacrificing security. Aaron and I speak about the rise of zero trust in a hybrid working world, and he's a great pub analogy for zero trust. We talk through what Aaron is hearing from his customers, advice for business and cyber leaders as they balance security with employee experience, and tips for secure remote working. Over to the conversation. Welcome to the Get Cyber Resilient podcast. I'm Gar O'Hara. Today, we are joined by Aaron Robinson, the head of pre-sales for Citrix. How are you going today, Aaron?
Yeah, doing very well. Thanks for having me on the show today.
Absolute pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Really, we haven't actually met before, so yeah, really good to have you on. And yeah, looking forward to the conversation today. So Aaron, look, the first question we ask pretty much everybody is just, how did you get to where you are today? So obviously you're head of pre-sales for Citrix, but I'm guessing you have a journey to get there.
Yeah, pretty much. So I started my IT career on a help desk, really, working for CSC, which is now DXC. Fast forward a few years and got into solution architecture, which I really love, designing solutions for lots and lots of different customers. And then the opportunity came up to join Citrix as a pre-sales engineer. So I've been at Citrix now for just coming up to 7 years. And in my time here, joined the pre-sales team. It's a fantastic company to work for, a fantastic team. And then I was lucky enough to move into to manage the Southern pre-sales team after being with Citrix for about 2.5 years. Really loved that. And then from there, I was given the opportunity to move into becoming head of pre-sales for Citrix ANZ. And so I've been doing this role now for about 2.5 years.
Fantastic. We are going to talk about zero trust. It's one of the, we're actually going to talk about quite a few different things, but we're going to start with zero trust. A very, very popular topic, I would say these days. I think, you know, many of the cybersecurity conferences, we're seeing this stuff talked about more and more. You guys do a particular kind of version of this, so I think I'm keen to kind of get your comments or your thoughts about the kind of rise of zero trust in a hybrid working world.
Yeah, it's an interesting space. So zero trust is sort of really starting to become the necessity for most organizations today. Research is showing that by 2023, 60% of enterprises will phase out most VPNs in favor of zero trust network access. And the reason for this is that we're finding workers and students are constantly mobile now. They're not tethered to the office anymore. They're typically working up to 3 different locations a week. And they're doing all of this while they're working across like 2 to 3 different devices. And they're also incorporating personal devices in their work life. So we need new security systems or frameworks to be able to really accommodate and incorporate that. Applications have started to move to the cloud. They've either been lifted and shifted from, you know, on-premise to more of an IaaS type solution in the cloud. And so that sort of sits outside the traditional perimeter that most organizations have in place today. All they're starting to consume that software as a service. So they've, you know, ditched that in-house developed application, and then they've, you know, taken something off the shelf, and they've got to put that trust into that software provider that's giving back that SaaS application. And what we're finding in most instances is that the traditional security that we have in our organizations, whether it be the VPN or just the corporate internet that goes out from the office, is providing a substandard level of quality to that SaaS application that they can get by just going directly to the internet. And so when we've been talking to lines of business users, when we try and understand some of their end user experience challenges, because it's another big focus of what, you know, I sort of talk to, we're finding that they're actually disconnecting from things like VPNs so they can go and access certain applications, whether it be corporate sanction, so an app that's being delivered by the actual organization, or it's an application that they've gone and bought themselves through shadow IT just to be productive. And in the midst of all this, the reason why we see zero trust being really important is that threats are continuing to evolve. They're becoming more automated. And I think zero trust is really key into being able to predict those deviations in people's behavior and prevent those threats from spreading across organizations.
Yeah, those deviations are kind of an interesting one. I've been talking to some security leaders who use things like end user behavior analysis, and you know, we're doing that pre-COVID, but when COVID kicked in, obviously all the patterns that had built up just got blew up because they didn't make any sense. To your point, people are working in, you know, three locations, different devices, but you know, it's a completely different set of patterns than, you know, arriving to the office at 8:30 and leaving at 5 from the same sort of IP ranges, etc. Have you seen, like, has that kind of been on your radar, like in terms of that, how end user pattern, you know, patterns of life, I think is what they describe it as, you know, like what does Aaron do every day? Like, how has that changed as COVID has arrived and work from home has just become much more normal?
Yeah, it's sort of two key areas for us in terms of the conversations that we're having in the market. The first one's specifically around security, in terms of what is a standard behavior in the way that they interact with our IT enterprise systems. And if that behavior starts to deviate, how do we start to automate actions to lock down that behavior if we deem it to be inappropriate?
Yep.
But what we found is that we swung the pendulum a little too far the other way in terms of, well, great at locking things down, that have really impacted that end user experience. Yep. So then how do we put processes and things in place so we can allow users to self-remediate? You know, a very simple example that I talk to customers about in that space is around, you go to work from home, you log on late one night, which is not typical for you. And rather than just block that access because it's outside of the defined normal paradigm that we've, you know, mapped within that tool, we might send an additional level of authentication, or we just might give you a much more restricted access to that particular level of app. So, and then on the other side of that, it's more around the performance of the platform. So we're able to tell how it's performing and what becomes normal for the user working from home, rather than tracking levels of productivity, for example.
Yeah, it's funny, the tracking levels of productivity, the boss were stuff that's starting to kind of emerge because of COVID. It's kind of creepy. I've been thinking about this more and more. The overlap with boss were, you know, that kind of productivity monitoring stuff. I mean, there's pretty substantial overlap between that and end user behavior analysis. You know, the security use case is definitely there, but a lot of the telemetry you'd collect, you could absolutely repurpose it and kind of, you know, is Gar working or is he buggered off for a nap in the middle of the day or whatever. It's an interesting one to watch, I think.
Yeah, it definitely is. And yeah, we do hear that a little bit from the field as well. Yeah,
definitely. With the sort of the work that you guys do, I'm guessing in your role, you would speak to lots of different organizations and you know, spend a lot of time in the field having conversations with security leadership. Very keen to get your sense of what the latest trends in security are, and even actually the challenges that you're seeing in our industry from your customers.
Yeah, so cybersecurity holistically at the moment is probably the front of mind of every customer that we speak to today. I mean, there are a few trends that come out of this, but it's not surprising because, you know, I was reading some reports last night and, you know, 67,000 cyber crimes have been reported in Australia between 2020 and 2021. And, you know, that costs an estimated $33 billion to private citizens, but organizations as well. So we're starting to see this become more of a business risk in a lot of the organizations and customers that we speak to, and not just the focus of IT. And boards are now incentivizing their executives in those organizations to be more proactive in that cybersecurity and reducing risk space. So those conversations are becoming more holistic across the customer base that we're speaking to. Mm. So I guess some of the key themes that have come out of that from those conversations that have been put in at the board level, we're seeing organizations focus on mitigation strategies like the Essential 8 that's been developed by the Australian government to reduce cyber incidents. And so government departments and, you know, critical infrastructure, for example, are really focused on how do they meet those three levels of maturity to get to that level to standard as a requirement now. The other area that we're spending a lot of time talking to customers about is application security, which has become a really big focus, and building that security either directly into the application or bolstering the application security that sits in front of it, because applications are really becoming that focus point for automated attacks. So you think bots or cross-scripting attacks and things like that, because historically when developers go and develop all these applications, they use a lot of open source software and tools, and then vulnerabilities pop up in them, like the recent ones that we've seen in the market today. And people are able to go and exploit those quite quickly. And then as people leave and they don't follow best practice in developing that application supply chain, for example, that sometimes they're not even aware of those vulnerabilities that sit in that application until it's too late. So that's another key trend that we're seeing there. But I think the most important for me and the topic of today's sort of discussion and what I'm hearing the most in the market is that zero trust security. And I kind of like to liken that to a pup. And I sort of talk to that in three key steps. And so, you know, the three steps that I relate it back to a pub is, you know, you need to provide ID so you can at the door before you get in and show that you're trusted. The next thing is that you need to behave appropriately when you're inside the pub. And then thirdly, depending on the credentials or the level of access that you've been given when you go in, only certain people can go and access the VIP area.
That's a very cool analogy. Can you kind of unpack that analogy in a bit more detail for us?
Yeah, no worries. So the way that I like to describe it is you think of when you first walk up to a pub, the first thing that happens is you've got to line up behind the velvet rope and the bouncer walks up and down to check to make sure that you're not too intoxicated, that you're dressed appropriately, and we're going to allow you to go in. So that's the first thing that we do from a zero trust perspective before we allow you to get access. The next thing that you do that I touched on before is that you hold up your hand over your ID to the bouncer. They have a look at the card. And if they don't trust or your photo's a little bit old, you don't quite look like who you say you are, they ask you some follow-up questions. And so that's the second factor auth, or the step up auth that I sort of related to. Once you pass that, you're allowed to go into the bar or to the nightclub. But the security doesn't end there. So once you go inside the bar or the nightclub, there's a whole bunch of bouncers that are inside watching the crowd and the audience, and specifically you, to make sure that you're having a good time, so accessing your apps and doing your work, but you're not doing anything malicious that may cause any destruction, dancing on the bar, getting too drunk, things like that. And if you do something malicious that's seen by the bouncers, they grab you, they throw you out the back, and you're not allowed to come back in. And that's the same thing that we do in the zero trust controls that we have. We're continuously watching you once you're inside the organization, continuously checking. And then if you continue to behave, you're more than welcome. You step out of line, we terminate your access and we kick you out of the network. And then, you know, to stretch that analogy a little bit further, there's obviously higher levels of security or private areas that some users need to go and get access to, like the VIP area, for example, in a nightclub or a bar. So when you go up to the VIP area, you might be wearing a wristband, for example, that the bouncer checks. Yes, you're good to come in and allows you in. That's the same principles that we apply in our zero trust network as well. So we allow users that may need to access a sensitive particular application if they meet a certain criteria, to go and access that application, whether they're working in the office, working from home. So that's kind of how I liken it, from zero trust security network access to when people go out to a nightclub or to a bar.
It's a great analogy. Very cool. I'm imagining myself in a bar in Dublin, just absolutely hammered on Guinness and thinking like, yeah, no one should trust me in a pub. Definitely not that kind of guy. Yeah, it's interesting. And you mentioned there, you know, about the application security and then the sort of vulnerabilities through supply chain and sort of, I suppose we're inferring Log4j, if I had to fill in the blanks there, this story. But like spot on, I think that's something that, you know, we've been talking about quite a lot lately, actually, is the huge amount of open source libraries that are out there and used and maintained by, you know, one person sitting in an apartment somewhere around the world, you know, doing the work voluntarily, producing, you know, some cool little bit of code that, you know, ends up in just a bizarre amount of places if it's good. And what blows my mind is there is no Q&A, quality assurance. There's nothing, you know, people just kind of reuse the code and away you go. And I also think, and I say this is a very lazy ex-developer, I think a lot of people just jump on Stack Exchange when they want to solve a problem and literally copy paste the code. And you know, you don't really put in as much thought as you probably should do sometimes into the, what does this mean? Is there any security vulnerabilities? They just, you know, there's a deadline. Let's get this thing out there and going. And then, you know, afterwards you potentially realize the Stack Exchange, as good as it is, might not be the, you know, the infallible source of truth. What do you reckon on supply chain? Like for you guys, obviously, you know, Log4j happened. I think the Department of Homeland Security in the US, didn't they say recently it's going to be like 10 years before we can mop up Log4j. How do you see that play out in the future, you know, in terms of other libraries? And then I suppose this is a huge question, but like, how would an organization even understand, like, do you have those conversations with customers about how they start to unpack where those libraries might be?
Yeah, so we don't sort of talk to them about where those libraries might be. We sort of take a different approach in terms of building security into the application that you're delivering. And then when you're front-ending it out to the application, putting security controls in place to protect them. So if you do have that potential vulnerability that sits in your application, we're able to prevent that attack or that SQL injection or something like that before it actually gets inside the network and then gets into that application. So when we can do that a few ways, it's whether doing it through the traditional application where you've got, you know, the front door where the user comes in and logs into the app, or we can do it through things like service mesh and API protection as well. So those are kind of the areas that we're talking to customers about in more detail rather than focusing specifically into the open libraries. The other thing that we do to talk to them about as well is, you know, should you be using open libraries in all of your application and development? Does it make sense, especially when you're trying to build that security framework around those applications, using something that you can get from a trusted vendor that provides that history, logging, auditing, trail, monitoring, all that sort of stuff in the back end as well?
No, definitely, that makes sense. And you guys obviously operate in sort of ZTNA, which is, you know, it's funny because I think when people think zero trust, that's often what they're thinking about is, you know, sort of zero trust network access rather than, you know, the full kind of philosophical approach of zero trust. Like, what are you guys able to do with the services that you guys run in ZTNA?
Yeah, so there's a lot we can do in that space. So I guess ultimately what it allows organizations to do when they come and use Citrix ZTNA framework is move away from really managing the device and start to focus on what's most important to the business. And from our perspective, that's really putting the security around the application at the endpoint and the data as well. And it's interesting, I often ask this question when I'm talking to end-user compute people and security people inside customers, and I purposely ask the question, sometimes speak provocative, but I'll say to them, you know, why do you care about managing the device? Like, why is that important to you, especially in today's day and age? And I usually get a few seconds of stunned silence before that, then start to try and almost justify it in a way, which is interesting. It's really interesting to hear them sort of stumble over why they need to manage that device when you can start to adopt these new security principles like zero trust network access. It can also be a very cost-effective way for security. It can also be a very effective way to provide security over unsecured networks.
Yep.
So now the businesses at the moment, they're not opening any new offices at all at the moment. Yep. From our perspective, when we go and talk to them. If anything, they're starting to look to reduce their real estate footprint. But they have opened thousands of branches of one, and they're putting enterprise, and they're not going to go in and put enterprise-grade firewalls in at each location. They've got challenges associated with trying to manage these devices that and secure those devices that are sitting out of these locations that are always connected to their network, right? So do you really want a device that hardly ever comes back into the office that could be sitting on someone's desk, unlocked, fully connected to your network, to have unfettered access once that VPN has been established? So Zero Trust goes a long way in providing that security in that space. So it only effectively allows that single application to connect directly back to your organization or to that cloud-hosted application. And the benefit of that too is it's not a user-initiated connection. It's connecting from your organization out to a central termination point. So it provides higher levels of security that way as well. I guess from my perspective, really simply, it's a higher security posture than traditional security methods. Traditional security methods do for remote work, and it's largely transparent to the end user. I think that's really key in terms of balancing high levels of security with user experience. Because as I touched on before, when we're chatting, from our perspective, what we find, if security is too obtrusive or too obstructive, users will actively try and seek out ways to get around it and just to get work done. They're typically not trying to be malicious. They're just frustrated with the processes and they just want to get their job done. So
It is such a funny one to watch, that, isn't it? The absolute explosion of shadow IT, but the ability for, you know, somebody in HR department or marketing to just drop a credit card and get access to stuff that, you know, potentially is exposing, you know, company IP or PII or whatever it may be. But trying to get the, you know, the toothpaste back in the tube is, it's difficult sometimes, you know, once it's sort of out there and people get it. To your point, you know, they're looking for ways to do their job and do it better. Like there's so little malicious intent often. But I don't think, you know, people fully comprehend what it means when they do use third-party tools to kind of get their job done as quickly as possible. By the way, I'm going to steal your, they're, you know, opening thousands of branches of one. So hopefully that's okay. I will be stealing that, that yeah, phrase no or whatever.
I like that one.
It is. It's such a good reflection of like how people work today, you know, and that's the funny thing. We have an office space, we go there, but honestly, the only thing that it's providing now is a hook onto the internet. It doesn't really matter where we are, you know, the setup for our machines in Mimecast, like it's absolutely, you know, mobile. The office doesn't serve any purpose other than, you know, there's no extra protection by being there. Other than, you know, protection from the elements, it's probably like the only protection it's providing at the moment, and a nice printer. But yeah, compared to the, like, you know, 15, 20 years ago, where the experience was, you know, going in and probably being a bit more cavalier, if I'm honest, you know, where you, when you're in that environment, because, well, it's protected, versus at home. You guys,
I was just going to add to that. You had an interesting point to the office, you know, going in where there was used to be all this extra protection. And, you know, one of the things that I think is the benefit of this Zero Trust technology and these technologies that are being released is that it allows customers to really reduce that IT complexity that sits in their data centers and sits out at their offices. And it can be a significant cost saver as well, especially as they need less office space, they need less security equipment at that office, and they can take on cloud services that provide better than the current security framework that they've got in place today. So
yeah, it's all sort of going in the right direction, I think, in terms of easy use and security, definitely. Good to talk about, and it's something I kind of, when I think Citrix, I often think of this, but like desktop as a service. I don't know, you guys do a ton of stuff, but, you know, sort of from having used your stuff over the years. Good to get a sense of like how organizations go about kind of protecting access to virtualized apps.
Yeah, it's a really good question, and something that I always sort of talk about Citrix that people don't initially think of when they think Citrix is that we've been a security company, you know, since day one for the last 30 years since we've been created, because the entire purpose for Citrix to exist and for people to use DAS is that it's an incredibly secure way for organizations to protect their applications and data. Whether it be across any device or any network. And with that idea, applications are, you know, the idea behind that is that applications are safe within the data center or in the public cloud, where a lot of customers are starting to deploy those workloads today, behind, you know, layers of security, whether that be, you know, ACLs that sit up within your public cloud provider, between firewalls that sit specifically within your data center, and then the security we supply on the actual endpoint to ensure that nothing from the endpoint can jump into that virtual application. But we definitely have seen threats evolve over time, you know, malicious code's getting smarter, automated attacks are coming in more and more, and they are focusing on the endpoint more and more. That's probably the number one attack vector at the moment that we're seeing. And so we've had to adapt our security controls too, in the way that customers can trust Citrix, I guess, to protect their DAS services. And so from our perspective, we've built into our DAS service those zero trust principles that people expect, whether that's offering additional capabilities like things like adaptive authentication or contextual access. And we try and take it a little bit of a step further too, instead of rather than just allowing an explicit allow or explicit deny, we might, for example, allow you to access that application, but we might do something like a session recording, or we'll watermark the screen, or, you know, we'll do things like block, cut, copy, paste, or even control what level of access within the application you get as well. So. And then I touched on it at the start, that, you know, security analytics or machine analytics platform that sits underneath it. You know, we can trigger actions if we start to detect threats when they're accessing those virtual applications as well. Yeah. And then add extra layers of protection as well. So we can block things like keylogging and then turn off screen captures and recordings and stuff like that to really clamp down on that attack if it's detected, for example.
Interesting. Yeah, it's kind of an interesting approach. And am I thinking about this incorrectly? But like, it's almost like browser isolation sessions where, you know, you can run a virtual browser in a data center. So if anything kind of detonates, it happens, you know, away from the, you know, the device or the endpoints or potentially even the network that the organization's running on. Is it like, is that the way, is that a kind of good analogy or am I missing it?
Yeah, 100%. We see a lot of benefit of that, especially even in a virtual desktop. When you click on a link, for example, that may be a zero-day attack, it opens up in that browser isolation service. Yep. And yeah, if something detonates or it shouldn't be doing what, you know, it's a risky website and it's made its way through all the extra layers of protection, it can't jump out of that browser isolation and get into your corporate network. It just, as you said, detonates in that container and then it gets deleted and thrown away. Yeah. So we've also got the ability to do that sort of locally on the user's device through an embedded browser, and it's exactly the same concept. It just runs locally as well.
Yeah, so. Yeah, very cool. I think there's a lot of stuff that's going to happen in the browser space in the future, because I think more and more when you think about what it means to work these days, apart from like, you know, installed productivity tools, you know, Office or whatever on a machine, I spend most of my day in a browser. And that means something different than it was like 15 years ago, where if I had said that, you know, I'd probably get fired because it was, yeah, like realistically, I was probably just wasting time. But it's amazing to me, like so many of our tools are SaaS platforms. And if I need to do something, I'm logging into a browser application. You know, nothing sits on my desktop anymore. So yeah, interesting space.
It becomes key as well in terms of, you know, just because it's a SaaS application, do we cede control entirely to the vendor, or do we now want to start to apply some controls in terms of what parts of that application that we can give to the user? So, you know, those CASB type functions in terms of, you know, is a very simple example of that might be, you've got someone in HR who needs to use LinkedIn, for example. So we're going to allow that, but we don't want the rest of the organization to go and search for jobs on company time. So, you know, start to provide that delineation of control, for example, in terms of what they can do. Certain SaaS-based applications. So,
yeah, it's interesting when you see that in flight, where you can do things like kind of blocking, I don't know, like a personal Google Drive, but let, you know, allow access to corporate, etc. So, very kind of exciting space there. A little bit of a pivot, and sort of maybe a interesting, like, big question again. But you know, for business leaders, when it comes to that balance between security protocols and probably processes, and then that the employee experience, which like traditionally has been a challenge, because you know, we all get it, and you know, the more secure you are, quite often there's more friction there for people to kind of go about their day. A second part of this question would be, what's your experience of that in terms of employees feeling we get it, you know we need to do MFA and sort of re-authenticate because it's for security, or are they kind of pushing back? But yeah, like any advice for business leaders, that balance between security protocols and employee experience?
Yeah, most organizations think it needs to be high levels of security or employee experience. They don't sort of think that there's a balance that can be struck there. But the truth is, if you don't get that balance right, people will just try and find a way around it. Like you said, they understand that, you know, there needs to be multi-factor and they need to follow the right protocols. Sometimes people just get frustrated and they just find a way. As they say, life finds a way. People will find a way around the security controls that you've got. So for me, I think, to get the balance right, security needs to work really closely with IT and lines of business, and they need to be really clear, I think, on the security framework that they've got across their organization, and then give some semblance of control back to those lines of business and IT to meet that framework. I think it's the security organization's role then to go and review that new application that they're trying to bring in, that new process that they're trying to deliver, that new outcome that they're working on, to make sure that it meets that security policy, you know, risk governance compliance type framework that the organization is comfortable with. And they need to do that in a timely manner as well. They can't spend, you know, weeks and weeks to get an answer back to them. And if the person that has submitted that request, for example, has done the right due diligence and followed the right frameworks and templates, that should become a fairly automated and seamless process. Because the last thing that you really want is security. And we hear this joke thrown around all the time when I talk to customers is, you know, I've got to go to the office of to get this approved. So you really want to see that security team as enabling the organization, not, you know, holding them back from being able to be innovative and deliver on their outcomes.
Yep. Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think there's that definitely that evolution of, hey, to use your term, like the office of no. I think security leadership to me these days seems to be more and more moving into the kind of navigation of politics and becoming the, you know, the department or the office of yes, you know, figure out how to get to business outcomes. Yeah, I definitely think that's been a change. And probably our last question, I think, just based on the time, like you guys obviously, you know, you sort of said you've been in a way a security company for 30 years, or, you know, certainly that has been a large consideration for you guys. And you're also kind of known for, you know, that ability to do things remotely and virtualize desktops and stuff like that. But what would you consider, like, if you've got tips for IT teams then that are going out and looking to enable secure remote work, you know, the folks who are doing digital transformation projects and trying to get to a position where if COVID, you know, 21 hits, or the, you know, the next pandemic or the next thing that happens, that they've got a resilience built into their organization because they've already got that secure remote work. But like, what tips would you give for IT teams?
Yeah, I guess my three top tips and the three that I usually talk to customers about is, you know, technology is only one piece of the puzzle to enable secure remote work. But I guess building on that, and this being a technical talk, you know, build a secure remote work strategy, and zero trust is that gold standard. And I think it must be included in any strategy that you're trying to deliver. You always want to look to simplify the user access as much as possible. So whatever the remote work strategy is, it needs to be a single place that they can go and access as all of their applications. But it needs to be flexible as well to meet the way that the user likes to work, whether that's integrating with the desktop or it's a portal that they can go to launch all their applications. And the security that sits behind that needs to be intuitive. Users don't want to have to jump through 30 different, you know, levels of authentication to get work done. The next point that I sort of talk to, and this is sort of where we move away from technology a little bit, but you need to create a culture for all employees to really thrive in and feel comfortable when they're working from home and they're working remote, both from just the day-to-day interaction with their line managers, their employees and their peers, but from a corporate responsibility and IT security risk and governance perspective as well. And so it doesn't just become IT's responsibility. They've got to spend time working with the business and they've also got to spend time. And the best person that I typically say to work with is HR, because they can be your best friend in terms of helping, you know, managers learn how to run and operate people that are working remotely, and managers need training since we've all gone to work from home. Employees need to feel comfortable as well. What's the new appropriate levels of when can I work from home? How do I work from home? What's acceptable and what's not? And then the last point, I guess, for me is to really start thinking of the role, and you touched on this in sort of the way that you asked the question, what role technology plays in the future of work, and is what we're doing today adaptable in terms of being able to meet the demands of tomorrow? So, you know, the zero trust at the moment is very flexible and adaptable in the way that we bring in all of our different applications and apply security around them. And it abstracts that away from the device. It makes it very easy for a user to go and pick things up off the shelf, like another device off the shelf, get that high level of security and then become productive. And the reason that I sort of use that as the specific example is that we're going through chip shortages at the moment. So as users are working from home and a machine dies, you know, how do they get a new machine out? Can they just go and pick up a BYOD device, plug it into the network, connect, get their applications, and they're good to go as long as it, you know, meets the security posture checks, for example? Or are they going to be stuck twiddling their thumbs until they ship out a repurposed device from the organization, or until, you know, there's a chip shortage? What do they do then? So those are the type of things I think they need to start to think about as they look at these remote strategies, is how do they play into our future plans, and how do we, you know, prepare for that future and what it might look like, and how adaptable and easy to update is it?
Fantastic advice. And the one thing we can be absolutely sure of is that the future will arrive, and it'll probably surprise us as it has done the last few years consistently. Aaron, so nice to have you join us today. I really, really do appreciate you taking the time and sort of giving us the insights based on your experience. So thank you.
No worries. Really happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much to Aaron for joining us. And as always, thank you for listening to the Get Cyber Resilient podcast. Jump into our back catalog of episodes and like, subscribe, and please do leave us a review. For now, stay safe, and I look forward to catching you on the next episode.